Thank you, team. Had to unravel a few things there. Now we're at this point in the meeting, like Jeremy talked about, where I'll make a it's a speech. You know, I kind of have some places where I think I'm hoping to bring up some things. I think God's doing some things among us that I want to name, and I want to give us some stimulus to talk about. And then when I'm through, you'll have a couple minutes too if you want to add some of what you're working with, or maybe you have some questions or problems that you want to kind of get up right then. So it's kind of an opportunity to get some dialogue going. So I hope that something in what I'm saying can kind of stir something up in you. I see that clicker. We're going to need that. So we're, at some level today, we're going through some issues that sort of like 10,000 leagues under the sea in terms of getting into something that's really deep that most of us don't really want to go towards. Not because we're stupid or we don't think it exists, but there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't go that deep in the ocean. I mean, first of all, of course, there are sea monsters. And if you don't think there are, please, by all means, go to the deep sea. Prove me wrong. Like, it's so scary to get in down where there's no light and there's crazy stuff. There's parts of the ocean floor that humans have not even seen. The amount of pressure that's down there. You get the picture, right? Going into the depths of some things like that are hard to get to, hard to see, and hard to not just kind of... We're a lot more comfortable, you know, on jet skis on the surface. And we'll do a little jet skiing, but most of the stuff I want to talk about might seem like it lives near the sea monsters. But to get there, I want to explore two main concepts around how our powerful collective memory might be, and then explore some of how we suffer a little bit. I want to make space for Jesus to answer some of our questions that we're going to have. To get us going, Bravely, Maya Angelou's a little bit of one of her poems is going to get us moving. In 95, she wrote this for the intent to read it to the United Nations on their 50th anniversary. So it's this sort of prophetic voice to call on them and call on humanity to get below our problems of the moment and have a more eternal worldview, especially on how we're relating and creating a world. So here it goes, and it's on here if you want to read it or you can just listen. When we come to it, then we will confess that not the pyramids with their stones set in mysterious perfection, nor the gardens of Babylon hanging as eternal beauty in our collective memory, nor the Grand Canyon, kindled into delicious color by western sunsets, nor the Danube flowing its blue soul into Europe, not the sacred peak of Mount Fuji stretching to the rising sun, neither Father Amazon nor Mother Mississippi, who without favor nurture all creatures in the depths and on the shores. These are not the only wonders of the world. And I want to get into just this little part right now, is talking about the kind of collective memory that maybe had something to do with building pyramids or the hanging gardens in the fabled city of Babylon. It was Maurice Albvox doing a lot of psychological work in the 1940s. He did this development of the concept of what we call today collective memory. The quick gist of that is that all people tell their stories. All people groups have a way that they tell the story of how they got there and what they've been doing. You know, this is a real normal thing we do. You might even be part of a newsletter from some group that you're connected to, and they send you something periodically telling you stories, and they're codifying this narrative. So narratives like that, memorials, like if you go around and like see things that are built to commemorate something, holidays and which ones we celebrate. There's different ceremonies, and there's this tradition, and all these things aid in shaping a collective memory. Sometimes groups of people use material to form their collective memories that other groups think are insignificant or trivial. But two of the questions that today's study raises is, how do people understand their past, and how does it change over time? So we're going to be working at one level of a collective memory that I'm going to bring up in a bit. And then there's an even deeper one that we're eventually going to get to. So how the collective memory for us most of the time works nowadays after some of Maurice's work is through television, film, and magazines and images. Just get burned into our heads and things that we all understand as just like, yeah, that's part of our story. You could call it pop culture, but especially TV and film over the past few decades, there are these iconic scenes that most people who grew up in the United States understand the reference to them. Here's a for instance, just after I deliver this line, just a show of hands if you know which film it's from. Luke, I am your father. Okay. And many of you have not even seen Star Trek. That kind of memory, even if you never saw The Empire Strikes Back, that you might understand why this scene that apparently was on some church somewhere in the United States kind of makes sense to people. Like, they don't even really understand what's going on in the scene. Some of the care, like, that was put into it. For those of you who, of course, I don't want to do spoilers, but the relationship between two of the characters here is quite crucial, and they're even their tension and the possibility of resolution is actually a lot of the tension of the whole narrative of the first three films. Again, and there are people in among us who haven't seen them. And we're not going to take this opportunity to shame them every time there's a Star Trek reference come up, but we don't want to spoil the ending for them. Somehow, though, when my oldest kid was watching them for the first time, I don't know, last year or something like that, she already knew what was going to happen with the father scene. It's like, how did you know that? I would never spoil that for her. That was like one of the best, you know, plot twists ever before M. Night Shyamalan. You know, it melted our minds when we were children. And who would blow that for a kid nowadays? Just nobody had to tell her. It's everywhere. It was in Toy Story 2. It was in a million different parodies and spin-offs and like people just doing this a reference to this scene that a bunch of us have never even seen the original of. That's collective memory. When you can make a reference to something, some image, something in the culture that's so powerful, whether you even have seen it or enjoy it or not, somebody can reference it in a spoof and you're like, oh yeah, that's from that. That's how collective memory works. While collective memories can be plot spoilers, they also house some deep esteem. Humanity as a whole, in some ways, can feel better. Each person can feel better about themselves when another human that they have no contribution to on a normal, like, conscious level, when they do something extraordinary because humanity accomplished something and I'm part of humanity. You know how that works? Like, humans did something and you just feel like, wow, the possibilities are endless for me because somebody else did something great. At the shale gas outrage thing that a bunch of us were spazzing out at, one of the speakers who I didn't like too much got up there and was talking and said this dated reference, and this is why I wasn't really into it, but she said something that like really was like, oh yeah, this is what she's talking about, this collective memory deal. She said this logic, talking about renewable resources and why we don't need to be dependent on fracking. That's a good point she's making. However, she says, if we can put humans on the moon than we can come up with renewable energy. So many of us don't even totally understand that humans were on the moon. We weren't alive the first time that it was supposedly broadcasted, because I don't even want to bring into my cousin Lucas's theory about the whole lunar landing thing. But if you ever want to talk to him, and you can. However, we feel something about that. If humans can do that, then we can do much, you know? And that's a kind of collective memory, too, even when that it was, well, most of us were not able to think about space camp yet or get, you know, into the possibility of whether or not we could go to the moon. Humanity did it. And that's the kind of, like, humans being capable of great things. That's the kind of stuff that Maya Angelou's banking on. You know, these sorts of feats could be these ancient wonders, like the pyramids and these things, but even more so the life-giving wonder of a good creation, these powerful rivers and mountains that are just totally defy anything we could possibly be capable of. So one of the great mysteries of the world that Maya Angelou isn't going to get to on this list is this eternal beauty that we all know deep down in this deeper level, that the Creator cares about us and Jesus loves us. We were formed through Jesus. That deep reality is where the sea monsters unfortunately live. And we would much rather deal with the stuff on the surface of the water, because the main reason is we also have this competing collective memory that we suffer. And when we suffer, we start to ask questions. And a lot of times those questions, like is going to happen here in the Gospel of Mark, are going to be to question God, question Jesus, question God's goodness, ask God, do you care? So if you've ever felt like that, then you can really relate to the apostles here in Mark chapter 4. And this is up here too. Later that day, when evening came, Jesus said to his close people that are, we'll get to the context in a minute, but they're on the one side of the lake and they're about to take a boat trip. Let's cross over to the other side of the lake. And then they left the crowd and took Jesus in the boat just as he was. Other boats followed along. Now gale force winds rose and waves crashed against the boat so that the boat was swamped. But Jesus was in the rear of the boat, sleeping on a pillow. When they woke him up, they woke him up and said, "Teacher, don't you care that we're drowning?" He got up and gave orders to the wind, and he said to the lake, "Silence, be still." The wind settled down, and there was a great calm. And Jesus asked them, "Why are you frightened? Don't you have faith yet?" And overcome with awe, they said to each other, "Who then is this? Even the wind and the sea obey him." Now, I like where this is kind of placed in the Gospel of Mark, because it's early on, just the chapter before he made these dudes his apostles. So they're still kind of getting used to who he is and what he's doing. But faith that gets us through storms is often different than faith that Jesus will stop all the storms from ever coming. Here's just some for instances of suffering right now that some of us are going through or people we know are going through. My backpack was stolen a week ago with my MacBook Pro that you gave me just a few months ago in it. I also had my passport and my checkbook and Game of Thrones book 4 and some other important things. Leanne and Zach's car that they just got smashed up yesterday outside my house while the cell leaders had a two-hour coffee meeting, and she couldn't go to the meeting, which she really wanted to be at. And their new car is smashed up. Hit and run. There are numerous relationship tensions among us. People who are having a hard time in marriages, some breakups, some fake marriages breaking up. It's a kind of a tense time, and a lot of people are kind of getting involved in the suffering that comes around. There's a lot of little kids around. Little kids cause their parents much suffering. And as you probably know now, parents cause little kids incredible suffering, even sometimes with good intentions. We have addiction issues that sometimes lead to violent behavior. A lot of us have sustained personal losses over time that keep coming back. So the same question I would say to Jesus sometimes, why don't you care? Do you care? And why don't you save me from my suffering? Why doesn't Jesus save us from our suffering? And this little story about Jesus and his friends hardly illustrates like the whole picture of humanity and how God works redemption in this large, you know, long story of creation. But it can be useful enough today to hopefully soften our defenses a little bit so we can go to Jesus too and see how he moves. So Jesus was teaching on, it's map time. Jesus is teaching on, this is the same, that the little one and this one are the same. He's teaching on the west side there of the Sea of Galilee, a.k.a. it's a freshwater lake, also called the Lake of Gennesaret. He's on the boat, according to Mark, in that chapter 4, and he's teaching people, and crowds start to gather. Some of them are in boats, some of them are on the banks. And they're about to cross over to the other side of the tracks, to where there's a different people group even. They're no longer where Jesus spent most of his time. We're kind of with people who had this basic like Hebrew culture and this a certain tradition and religious understanding and political leanings and all the tensions that were in there. That's usually who he was hanging out with. Now they're going to go over to the east side of this lake to hang out with the Gerizenes, where he's going to go and heal some demon-possessed dude and throw the demons into a whole drift of swine that's going by. And those of you who are familiar with like taboos of Jewish culture realize like there's not going to be herds of swine hanging around with Jewish people, right? So it's like telling, there's these kind of context clues even in a story of who he's relating to and who he's going to do stuff with. Those on the east side, yeah, so Jesus has this intent to go and cross over. And in order to cross the water, we're singing about what? The crossing the Jordan or getting over to the Jordan, which is this, talking about the river here, but it's this figurative kind of the struggles of our life becoming over and being into the promised land that God has for us. To make that transition is not going to be, you know, most of the time, sorry to keep hating on jet skis, but just kind of jet skiing around the lake and woo! We're going on a journey with Jesus to do some stuff. It's party time, you know? How much of our life is like that? I mean, if you own jet skis or have access to them and you ever want to hang out with me with your jet skis, I'm not saying that I won't. I want to, but just spiritually, I think, if you're thinking that this whole thing is jet skis rather than you're going to kind of cross, you know, 8 miles. Today it's 8 miles wide. Back then it was probably even bigger. There's going to be some storms. And that's kind of part of the reality of creation. It's this dynamic and even dangerous at times wild place. And it's beautiful and it's treacherous. Most of the time, just this is like a little tip of studying the Bible, I guess. But when we understand the location of where things are happening in the Gospels, most of the time it's kind of around Jerusalem, which, you know, is kind of way far down compared to what Jesus is doing today. You know, kind of like down here, if you could extrapolate the image. But you can see that there's always more levels to these stories if you're looking at a map even or looking into some of the peoples who are mentioned or some of those clues. But in this story in Mark, though, the thing about Jesus is he does not stop the storm from coming. And that always kind of bothers me. I just, you know, I kind of have this entitlement issue because I was born after 1960, I guess. So I just deal with entitlement issues. So that's kind of where I read the Bible and I'm like, that's jacked up, Jesus. And if you were going to cause a storm to like stop, why not be really powerful and cause it to not happen? You know, and that's just, I know it's logical and that's like, you know, I also have the whole sci-fi thing and I'm entitled. So I have a lot of problems to like, in order to read the Bible, I have to get through a lot of stuff. However, whether Jesus knew it was coming or not, doesn't really matter. And whether or not he thought a nap is like the best thing to teach them trust or to teach them faith, or if he was just tired, we don't really know. But if he's going to stop the storm from putting them in danger, Why didn't he just stop that storm and all storms from happening? And I think that this is a real problem for us, not even a funny version of it. Our suffering is bad enough. You know, but I wonder, where did our collective memories kind of make the logical connections where that we are not supposed to suffer and that God isn't paying attention to us when we are in danger or in pain? I'm not sure when that kind of started leaking in there, especially in the last couple hundred years after the Enlightenment, but that's something that we all deal with when we suffer. I don't think that the argument, if God exists and is loving, then you will have no pain. I don't think that worldview, that argument, is made out of our holy stories or our faith traditions or out of some real spiritual insight. But it's because, it might be because some shallow kind of, some jet skiing kind of people. Man, if you are a jet skier, we got to talk afterwards because I really don't mean this literally as much as you think I might. But the jet skiers taught us that if God loves you, then you'll prosper without any hardship. And those messages are out there, but they're not real life. And they're not the world that God created. So what's really happening in this even story? The sea is kind of big, but the people that Jesus has with him, a lot of them are vocational fishermen from that region. So they're used to stormy waters and the other boats that are following them. I doubt if it looked like the movie A Perfect Storm that Jesus is going to be like, let's cross that. And other boats are like, yeah, totally, let's go. It'll be awesome. Let's go to like the other side of the tracks. You know, it probably was looking pretty calm, you know, and then the storm kind of came out of nowhere that even the fishermen couldn't see coming. But the storm happening probably wasn't the hugest deal if it was like just a storm, like, you know, you stepped in some bubble gum or something like that and your new shoes have gum on them. Probably something more significant when they're afraid of drowning. And Jesus did on the boat what he always will do. First, when he hears, when something dangerous is happening, we go to Jesus and we ask the same questions. Do you care or what? And that's, I guess it's kind of okay to have that and bring that. You know, I don't think it's like your whole self coming to Jesus, but if that's your instinct to say, don't you care? I think that's a place to connect. At least you're engaging with God. And it's not this rhetorical, don't you care? I'm not even looking for you. I'm just kind of judging you. You know, and Jesus responds with coming towards us in our suffering and offers hope. And then he asked his friends, you know, don't you have faith yet? You know, why were you afraid? And those questions, I think, sound so condescending when we can read it, you know, and like this sort of Jesus is just like, why were you scared? Don't you know that I'm here and I was sleeping? You're fine. Don't you have like any faith? Hello? Don't worry about the water. What's the big deal? You know, and you're just kind of like, Jesus is like snarky emo Jesus all of a sudden, you know, and you're like, whoa. But you know, test your God image. How is, when you read that stuff, does Jesus sound snarky and like, you know, paternalistic? Or is he asking them, how's the faith thing coming along? You don't have faith yet? Why are you afraid? And he probably listened. Why are you afraid? You probably have some reasons. Let's get into that stuff. So here's just a sort of personal story that I think can help wrap it up a little bit. When my backpack was stolen, right? It wasn't just to me like that it was expensive equipment or that there was sentimental info on the computer because, you know, of course, there was, you know, photos and videos and all that kind of stuff. But there was more than just all my like internet banking and banking accounts being compromised. So it would have to do a bunch of like fraud protection stuff. You know, it's more than it just being basically my fault because I left it in an unlocked car at a restaurant for 2 hours. You know, those things compound the problems, you know, but there's loss, there's anger, there's self-punishment, and there's a million, I wish I would have just done this one little thing differently, statements. And all that was when I had to go and drive to the airport and take the red eye right after I found out. And so I didn't even get to talk to Martha about this yet. You know, then I get back, you know, the first thing, hey, how you doing? Hey, I flew all night and my stuff got jacked right before I left. But this is how Martha does. with me this time. She does it a lot like Jesus does it, I think. She cared about my feelings about it. She didn't just come out and be like, oh, you're so stupid. You lose stuff. You lose important stuff. How dumb are you? You didn't lock the car. Where do you live? Where are you from, dude? You're so dumb. Why did we even get you nice things? You just trash them all the time. That wasn't her attitude, or at least that's not what she verbalized. She felt the loss with me. She gave me the space to process, and then when I was ready, helped me work out some responses and some suggestions about what we could actually do to make it better. She didn't jump into just fix it mode, but she, you know, entered into my suffering and then helped move into something else with me, even as we're still doing it. So, I mean, that's just a story about how I'm working it out right now with this kind of major problem. But I'm working out with Jesus, and I'm including others in the process. And that's a healthy way to heal. And I'm not just kind of dragging them into my chaos. I'm allowing them to help. When they're offering things, I'm taking them and doing what they say. These are messages to close here. In our collective memory, that God doesn't, there are these messages at the jet skier level. God does not care about your problems. And there's a deeper collective memory, being that we remember in this deep way of being created people, being part of a good creation through Jesus and through love. And what Jesus did not only affected the people he was with, but it continues to work. You know, when we remember these sacred stories and look for meaning in them, it's powerful, but even more potent is that more than just calming, having, you know, a holiday called Calming the Storm Day, we live a life where we turn to Jesus in our suffering and look to Jesus for help. Jesus did not come to save us from our suffering, but Jesus comes to save us in our suffering and lead us to somewhere else, somewhere much more generative and redemptive. Thanks for listening so much. Let's be quiet for a moment, and then we'll have some time if you want to have some talk back.